WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The war in Yugoslavia has widened the gulf between the U.S. and Russia, which has condemned the NATO bombing. Yesterday, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright met with her Russian counterpart, but little progress seemed to be made in closing the gap or creating a coordinated strategy to develop a peace plan. My guest, Serge Schmaiman, is an expert on Russia. He's the former Moscow bureau chief for the New York Times, where he's now acting foreign editor. Schmaiman is also the author of the book Echoes of a Native Land, a history of the Russian village which had been part of his family's estate before the family was driven out by the Russian Revolution. The book has just been published in paperback. I asked Serge Schmaiman about the historical reasons behind the alliance of Russia and Serbia.
Historically, there is a sense that these southern Slavs, Yugoslav, it means that, are kinfolk, are relatives, and they share the same Eastern Orthodox faith in World War I. And the Russians, of course, watched very carefully and before that. So there is a sort of an almost spiritual sense of a bond. Now, you can't take that too far. Perhaps it works when they both feel threatened from outside, but certainly the Russians had no love for Yugoslavia during the communist era, the Soviet Union. And, there is no great permanent alliance or linkage. You know, the languages are not all that close, although there are many common roots. But there is a sense that we are both Orthodox Slavic countries and we're both confronting a West that is to some degree callous and some degree patronizing towards us. Secondly, I think what we're beginning to see now is a certain bond, a certain linkage of old communists. Milosevic's wife is quite an adamant communist nationalist. The Russian parliament is very much dominated by communist nationalists or nationalist communists, whichever way it works better. And that these people are beginning to see in this a certain chance to ride nationalist feelings back to some influence and power. You know, the strongest noises are being made by the old communists, whether in Russia, Belarus, or Yugoslavia. So there are two bonds, two sort of tenuous bonds, which are being activated by this conflict.
Are there Russian agendas that are less than obvious that you could tell us about?
I don't think so. I think that in this case, they are improvising. And in fact, I think they have a certain problem. The Yugoslavs would like to draw them in as allies. The Yugoslav parliament has spoken of an alliance of Russia, Belarus, and Yugoslavia. And I think that's farther than the Russians would like to go. They still rely heavily on Western aid. They don't want to be totally excluded from global activities, from some some dealings with the United States. And so I'm not sure they want to go any further towards the Yugoslavs than they already have. But if this continues, I think both their public opinion and their own sense of indignation could drive them closer towards the Serbs. I'm not sure this is something, though, that they really desire or seek.
You know, I understand why people could be outraged at the bombing of Serbia, where civilians can get hurt. But it's hard to understand how people could side with Milosevic if they have any idea of what's happening in Kosovo. Could you explain why there seems to be this growing support in Russia for Milosevic?
You know, I think in a curious way that you can separate the two, indignation over Kosovo and support for the Serbs, not so much for Milosevic. And it's not only the Russians. This is something we've seen in other parts of the world, including Greece, for example. And I think part of it is an irritation with NATO. It's been growing for quite some time. There is a sense that NATO is becoming a Western club, that NATO and the Americans in particular don't understand the Eastern world, that they have no idea what's going on there, that a large part of this policy of bombing, of reacting, is almost improvised, that there is a quality of a bully to it, you know, that NATO will impose its own solution on this problem. That's the one part, I think, that, you know, much of it is just irritation with the West rather than specific support for the Serbs or for what they're doing. And secondly, I am not sure that anyone out there is getting a full picture. I know that Russian television did not show many of the scenes from Kosovo that we have been watching for quite a while. And now I gather they are beginning to, and perhaps getting a clear idea of what the Serbs are doing in Kosovo. And I'm sure once people see what's going on there, they do become indignant, they do become angry about it, but that does not translate into support for NATO. There is still a larger resentment of NATO and the role it has of a sort of a self-proclaimed peacemaker.
You know, you've written recently about the paradox of increased ethnic fighting during a time of globalization and jet travel and the internet uniting us, things that are making the world more interconnected. So how do you make sense of this paradox?
Well, I think we have found that the collapse of the communist world, of the old sort of bipolar world, black and white, us and them, has forced us to see again that, in fact, in many parts of the world, there are still lingering tribal, religious, ethnic identifications which are very strong. And even in an age of globalization, a dictator, a leader seeking autocratic power, finds this to be the easiest tool. So, you know, even a young Serb who's on the internet every day, speaks perfect English and has lived in Germany, can be inspired by a dictator, by Milosevic, to feel some Serbian feelings. I mean, even all these people who marched against Milosevic 2 years ago have joined in supporting the government on the war effort, because something stronger takes hold when you feel that your country is at war, that your country has to be supported when your country is being bombed. So we find that people have been quite successful, whether Saddam Hussein or Hafez Assad in Syria or Milosevic in Yugoslavia, in exploiting these feelings now that they have once again emerged from under the blanket of a bipolar world.
Sir Schmaiman, you're now the acting foreign editor at the New York Times, and I'm wondering if the Times reporters have been allowed back in Belgrade.
We have had one reporter, Steve Erlinger, doing a superb job all along. I mean, he was expelled for, I think, 2 days when everybody was chased out, and then his visa was valid and he was allowed back in. And he has been in Belgrade ever since, reporting on the people, how they're taking it. He's ventured out of town. For example, when the train was bombed, he was at the scene. We hope to get more people in. For now, Kosovo is closed to our reporters, and we're trying to get more people into the Serbian part as well. In Kosovo, of course, it's very important to get witnesses in on the ground to see exactly what has happened. We're dealing to such a degree on the statements of refugees and on the claims of NATO and the Pentagon. And we are really anxious to get witnesses of our own into that part of Yugoslavia to see what is going on.
How are you trying to get your reporters into Kosovo?
Basically, constantly waiting and looking for openings to see if the Yugoslavs will let them in, to see if they can drive down from Belgrade. You know, they are constantly asking and probing so far without meeting much success. In a situation like this, of course, the New York Times and any other news organization is very wary of having people injured. So there is a certain reluctance to sneak people in, of course. because it is dangerous in there. There is bombing, there's roving bands of soldiers, there's all the obvious hazards. But it is terribly important to have somebody, as soon as possible, give an independent account of what has gone on and what is going on.
My guest is Serge Shmaiman, the New York Times acting foreign editor and former Moscow bureau chief. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Serge Shmaiman. He's the New York Times acting foreign editor and the Times' former Moscow, Bonn, and Jerusalem bureau chiefs. He's also the author of the book Echoes of a Native Land, Two Centuries of a Russian Village, which has just been published in paperback. You'd mentioned that Russians see NATO as this like Western club. Do you think that Russia and Yugoslavia and maybe Greece see this kind of connection through the Orthodox religion? Even though religion was taboo in Russia for so long, it's still such a part of the culture.
Certainly, that is a very major part of the bond they feel. As you say, of course, religion was suppressed in Russia for a long time. It is now emerging. It has not emerged fully yet as a dominant force in Russian life or in Russian culture. And Greece, of course, has had all the erosion of secularization, of modernization. So even if religion is no longer a dominant force in either society, it is one that forms a historical bond between them. They were all part of the Byzantine Orthodox world. And I think their sense is one that the Western Christianity, whether Catholicism or Protestantism, looks at them in a condescending way. You know, it's when the Pope demands an Easter pause in the bombing without taking into account that the Orthodox Easter is on a different date. This kind of thing leads to a perception that the West treats the East and their religion and their orthodoxy, which of course is every bit as ancient and as deep and as widespread, perhaps, as Western Catholicism, but they feel that it's treated in a condescending, patronizing way. So these things do create certain resentments that bring the Russians and Greeks together in this sentiment.
Serge Shmaiman, in your book Echoes of a Native Land, in which you research the history of the village that your family is from, you write a little bit about your father, who was an Orthodox priest. And when he came to the United States, you say he became the guiding spirit in forming the Orthodox Church in America, and then also did radio broadcasts to Russia. Was it through Voice of America?
Through Radio Liberty.
Through Radio Liberty. Why was the Orthodox religion so important to him to keep alive in America at a time when it was being suppressed in Russia?
Well, part of it was that. Part of it, of course, is faith. He did believe in this, but his fundamental belief was that the Orthodox faith is universal. Many of the groups, the ethnic groups, the refugees coming to America clung to religion because it was sort of a unifying force in their ethnic communities, whether it was Romanian, Bulgarian, Russian, Ukrainian, whatever. So they use the faith more as an ethnic bond. And my father's fundamental principle was that Orthodoxy is universal and equally applicable to the American situation, to the Western situation. And therefore, our church, the Orthodox Church in America, the church in he was instrumental in forming is really an American church. The services are all in English, and the ethnic bond is in no way stressed or present.
What impact did it have on your ability to report in Russia when you were the Moscow bureau chief? And the authorities must have known that it was your father who was doing these Orthodox broadcasts through Radio Liberty.
I've often wondered, they never attacked him, and they never attacked my connection to him directly. They attacked every other member of the family, and they attacked me. I have a feeling that at some point, the KGB, which was, like everything else in the Soviet Union, a huge and clumsy bureaucracy, made the decision that they don't want to draw attention to this link. Now, they knew that my father is quite well listened to, that he has quite a bit of authority. And if they declared, with whatever purpose, that I am in fact his son and made a big deal of this, this would only draw attention both to his radio broadcasts and to me, and an attention that they probably thought wouldn't be in their interest. That's the only way I can interpret it, because they consistently failed to draw the connection between us or to attack him in the press.
What about the Russian people? Did you run across a lot of people who heard your name and thought of your father and really respected and appreciated the work that he was doing?
Certainly, especially among the intellectuals, the intelligentsia. He was very widely known. He spoke not only on spiritual themes, but also about literature. So, you know, it was a very wide audience. His broadcasts were passed around on cassettes or in written form, and samizdat, as they called it, underground. So, and his books were as well. So he was a well-known figure, and it gave me a certain credibility, instant credibility in a certain part of the population. So I think that certainly was in my favor.
My guest is Serge Shmaimin. He's acting foreign editor at the New York Times. He also served as bureau chief in Moscow, Bonn, and Jerusalem. He's the author of a book called Echoes of a Native Land, Two Centuries of a Russian Village, which is part memoir, part history. It's a book in which he explores the history of the village that his family is from. I'd like to talk with you a little bit about that book. Your family was ordered out of the country by the Bolsheviks in, I think, 1918?
What happened was after the takeover of the land by the Bolsheviks, they were allowed to stay for a while, but then subsequent order came down when the a more intensive crackdown began on the land to throw out all former landowners, and so they were driven out. But the villagers, the peasants, were tremendously loyal because they had a fairly good bond, and so they took them under armed guard to Moscow to make sure that they are not harmed along the way. They then stayed, most of them, outside Moscow. My grandfather and his brother left immediately after the war and made their way to France, but great-grandfather and sisters and others stayed and tried to make a go of it. But then one of their sons was arrested and executed by the Bolsheviks, and then they realized that they can't stay, and so at the very end of the 20s, they bought their way out, as many people were doing at that time. And so in 1928, they made their way to Paris.
Did studying your family history in Russia teach you a lot about purges and intolerance in ways that you feel you've constantly been applying to current stories?
Oh, it's hard to say, you know, I've came to the United States. I was six and basically have grown up as an American. And I think, you know, most of my instincts and the perceptions are those of largely shaped by how I've grown up as an American. But I think, you know, just living abroad for many years, we lived abroad for 21 years, in all these various foreign assignments, it makes you quite sensitive, perhaps, to cultural differences. It makes you quite wary of imposing, you know, a certain model. And sometimes, you know, we do get the feeling that the United States, which does have this remarkable functional democratic economic model, you know, which really is so extraordinarily effective and perhaps even just. So we begin to presume that it is universally applicable, and then we learn to our great dismay that it's not, that not every culture, and then in fact most cultures, are not prepared for a system of this sort, that they don't have the basic building blocks, whether in terms of democratic tradition, in terms of fair play, or in terms of economy, that they don't have the basic building blocks to handle our system. And so then we are dismayed. I think Russia is one example. You know, all of our all of our perception of Russia today is based on the fact that their democracy hasn't really succeeded and that their economy is in shambles. But I think, you know, if we try to look at other things, culture, for example, which is very strong, we'd find that, you know, there are great books being published, superb poetry, that in fact there is freedom of expression, which is expressed for those who watch Russian television in superb documentaries. You know, so we don't look at the things they do well. We look at the things we expected them to do, which they've failed to do. Now, granted, you know, economic development and politics is terribly important, but what I'm saying is we always have to be careful, and this is something I have learned in the years abroad, we have to be careful not to constantly superimpose our own templates on every other part of the world.
My guest is Serge Shmaiman, the New York Times acting foreign editor. He's also the Times' former bureau chief in Moscow, Bonn, and Jerusalem. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Serge Shmaiman, New York Times acting foreign editor and former Moscow bureau chief, and author of the book Echoes of a Native Land, about the Russian village his family is from. Did finding your family's place in Russian history help connect you to the meaning of history?
It did very much. Not two ways. One is searching out their history, finding it in the archives, in their memoirs. It was an enormously gratifying kind of exercise because I learned so much, because there was so much to learn. I did not come up against frustrations. You know, doors would open. I kept finding more and more archives. But I think what made it really remarkable was that I had already spent about, you know, 9 years in the Soviet Union, in Russia, and that my basic root search coincided with the process of a country rediscovering its own past. You know, the Bolsheviks, the communists, had maintained a brutal grip on the past. This was their monopoly. They wrote histories. They told you what you could remember, what you couldn't remember. They controlled the images, who were heroes, who were the enemies. And so suddenly an entire nation is freed to reassess its own past. And for me, the fascination of the process was the degree to which it coincided with what Russia was doing. You know, we would sit, when I would go to an archive, the people there, the archivists, would sit with me for hours just discussing what I was finding, and they became so involved that there were times when they would, you know, come to my house in Moscow and say, look what else I found. And, you know, it was a joint process of going backwards, which lasted for a few years. Of course, then Russia's own problems took over. The past became less fascinating, you know, because the present became stage center. And to some degree, we parted ways. To some degree, the project ran its course and ended. And I mean, when I end the book, people say it's a bit perhaps sad, perhaps pessimistic, because basically I leave a Russia that I feel slipping away again, slipping into a form that is not necessarily welcoming to me, and in which I really no longer have a part. And so when I leave, it is with the knowledge that I really don't belong there. I found my place there. I claimed my place there in that history, but it's not my place any longer.
In what sense do you feel the country slipping away?
It went back to the instincts of, well, how should I phrase this? I mean, it's what I was saying, you know, their unfamiliarity with democracy. They were, you know, the way that Yeltsin had to bomb his own White House, the way the church was becoming very nationalist in its orientation. You know, they were still very much their own nation, and the scars of communism, you knew, would take generations to heal. They were still very much shaped by these 70 years of communism, by the history they'd had before, by the fact that they really have never had what we know as a rule of law, where the law is above all. All these things are not yet familiar, They were again becoming suspicious of me. Why was I there? You know, here I was, an American who wasn't sort of spending money, investing, wasn't doing all the things I'm expected to
That's
do.
That's right.
Just raising a lot of questions. And so they found that they have no need of me any longer. And I ran out of things to ask. And we parted ways. I still am in contact. I get letters. I have terrific friends. But the book, in a way, I guess as Roots books tend to do, it satisfied that part of me that needed to lay a claim to this part of my heritage.
Well, Serge Maimon, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Serge Maimon is the New York Times acting foreign editor and former Moscow bureau chief. His book, Echoes of a Native Land, about the Russian village his family is from, has just been published in paperback.